The study of the dark arts can lead the fool to the depths of madness. However, with the proper understanding, it can serve as a catalyst to enlightenment. Learn everything you need to know about the occult. Tarot, numerology, astrology, spirit work, chaos magic, hermetic philosophy, demonology, banishing and protection, and much more. The most comprehensive course on magic available. Occult science applicable to any path without dogma or pointless rituals. Students of the Order of Chaos are free and encouraged to pursue any spiritual or religious path that they choose. Learn to hack reality. For more information, visit theorderofchaosmagic.com/mysteryschool. New classes starting soon. Limited availability. The Order of Chaos Mystery School. Knowledge is power.
The following message is transmitted.
Welcome back to the Order of Chaos podcast. Today, my guest is David Shoemaker. David is the author of Living Thelema, which is a wonderful guide to the practices of Thelemic magic and to the magic of Aleister Crowley. And if you're like me and you find Crowley's work to be daunting and hard to understand, overwhelming, or seeming like it's just too much for you, I highly recommend this book. It boils things down in a way that makes it understandable to maybe the average occultist or someone who, if you're like me and you have ADHD and you struggle with structured systems, this really makes it a lot easier. David is also a practicing psychologist and specializes in cognitive behavioral therapy and Jungian psychology. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm very excited for this. And of course, as usual, I want to give a big shout out to Wiser Books for setting this interview up, making it possible. I can't say how much I appreciate them and all the great authors that they send my way. So if it's okay with you, David, I would like to skip over some of the basic questions that you probably encounter a lot of the time, like what is Thelema and, you know, the basics, and jump into some of the more specifics and more interesting areas of this realm of esotericism, as I have a lot of questions that I would like answered for my own personal self. And I'm just hoping my listeners will be able to follow along and get the same benefit from that I do.
Sounds great.
Okay. So, Thelema, Aleister Crowley. The first thing I would say about this is that I've always struggled with really structured magical systems. I've always been deeply interested in magic since I was 14 years old, up until the present day, and it's only become more and more of an obsession. But when I look at some of Crowley's books or the Thoth Tarot and the complexity of those systems, I just go, oh my gosh, that's a lot. It gives me a headache right away. But your book I found to be fantastic because it, like I said, it boils a lot of that down into a way that's system that's easier to understand. One thing though that really gets me is that if you're studying Thelema, if you're looking into Thelema, I should say, you will find so many contradictory opinions. And these people are rock solid in their contradictory opinions. So when I was reading through your book, I had my neighbors probably heard me laughing because I laughed out loud so hard. I think it's one of the first chapters when you're talking about the Holy Guardian Angel, and you say that the first line is that the Holy Guardian Angel is akin to what's also known as the higher self. Now that sentence right there could trigger a whole lot of people, because I've had other people on this show say that's absolutely not what it is.
Right.
So
yeah, that's a great, yeah. That's a great point. Excuse me. That's a great point, and it's really is one of the central points of argument for the entire system of Philema. To be fair to myself, I was indicating that what I was trying to indicate in that chapter is that there are a lot of different ways that the HGA is talked about and thought about. There is a school of thought, including Crowley's own words at certain points in his career, that the HGA was like the higher self, like an aspect of self, a higher, you know, function of the psyche, akin to the Kabbalistic Neshama or something like that. But at other places and at other points, he talks about the HGA clearly as an external entity. And I'm not actually making a doctrinal statement about what it is. What I'd like to do is have people know that if you pursue the system and get to the place where you are ripened for knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel, you'll have all the answers you need about what it actually is to you. And so I think sometimes in my efforts to give a lot of broad possibilities, it may even sound like I'm trying to pin it down more than I am. So I might not have to argue too aggressively with anyone who says it's definitely not the higher self, because it's, I know what it is to me. And my experience, quite frankly, was beyond anything I could conceive of as an aspect of self. So I, if anything, I fall more on that side of the fence.
I agree. And I disagree at the same time. And I'll tell you why. Before that, let me go to my next question, because you've touched on it a little bit already. Now, do you, as a, you've been a lifelong, essentially, practitioner of these.
All my adult life, Yeah,
your adult life. And I know that you're involved with not only the AA, you are a chancellor in, it is, I'm sorry, I'm going to get the name wrong, so I'm going to read it right here, the Temple of the Silver Star.
Correct.
Now, are these aren't strictly Thelemic organizations, or organizations that incorporate the teachings of Thelema into their own framework. Is that accurate?
Well, the AA is the extension of the organization that Aleister Crowley founded, of course, but the Temple of the Silver Star is a Thelemic order patterned on the Golden Dawn. So it's a hybrid of, some of the landmarks of the Golden Dawn cipher manuscripts and that kind of Tree of Life degree structure, but incorporating the wide array of Thelemic practices and doctrines.
Okay. Okay, next question. Within this practice, do you personally, two-part question, you personally, and let's say, I don't want you to speak for other people, but as a general understanding, are the practices of the AA Golden Dawn Thelema thought to be objective facts about the spirit realm, or a set of metaphors with which one can use to access the spirit realm? Mm-hmm. Which of these is more accurate?
That's a great question. I think there are landmarks, milestones of personal spiritual progress that, while entirely unique to each individual, can kind of map out in ways that are somewhat predictable. So you could build a system with some tools in it that would help someone who's an entirely different kind of person attain, just as it would someone else, you know. So I think there is an objective ladder, you know, that's built in to the human psycho-spiritual apparatus, whatever you want to call it, that allows us to create systems of initiation. But ultimately, I think we can't get away from the truth that since each person has their own subjective experience of what the color green is, much less something really complex like the magical path, I don't see how we can argue that there's not a great deal of metaphor and mapping, you know, going on with these systems, so that we don't confuse the terrain for the map, you know, as they say.
I do. And I think that was a really brilliant response. I'm a little blown away. That's fantastic. I couldn't agree more. In fact, I'm going to take this opportunity now, because I forgot to in the beginning, to shamelessly plug my own system of initiation. So there will be a second class date starting for the Order of Chaos Mystery School. So if you are interested and you missed the first class startup back in January, there is a new class starting on June 4th. All the information is on my website and will be linked down below. Now, back to the interview. So great response, because this is one of the things that has irked me a little bit about particular magical systems, is that I don't, through my understanding of occult fundamentals, which I would say begins with the teachings that are within the Kybalion. I wouldn't say that it starts with the Kybalion as a book, but with the Hermetic principles. That's where I believe so many occult traditions spring out of, is that even if it's not from a particular writer, but from the understanding of things like as above, so below, as within, so without, right? That seems to be almost universal throughout Western occultism. Mm-hmm. And through those understandings, it seems to me that these things must have a degree of subjectivity to them. While at the same time, now I'm currently involved in a book that I'm working on with Peter J. Carroll, who's the founder of Chaos Magic. And he and I disagree about a number of things, one of which is the use of astrology. I look at astrology and I see objectivity. I see a way to see a person's blueprint, essentially. And because I do this for my students, for my clients, I've probably given about 1,000 astrology readings. I've never once seen a chart where it's like, nope, this doesn't make sense, doesn't add up, that's not real. And that has not happened one single time. So while I see that there's a degree of objectivity to what we're doing in occultism, there's also this wild degree of subjectivity about how you view it and what symbols interact with you in particular ways.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So within the framework of Thelema, of the Golden Dawn, is there any room for interpretation, or is the strictness of the system there to ensure your progress?
The strictness in the system is there to make sure that certain tools and skills are adequately trained at certain stages. But what each individual does with those tools and the personal mysteries that they uncover with those tools, no one could possibly predict for them, you know. But when we, to give some examples, when we're training someone on the use of the body of light, the tools for astral projection or scrying or things like that, or if we're testing people on their yoga, testing postures, testing for pranayama results, and so on, those are building blocks, but and landmarks that need to be tested, I think, for this particular approach. But within that, it's a huge, there's a huge openness to each individual's, their own findings and their own, certainly their own philosophical or religious interpretations of things we don't meddle with at all. We present tools that have been tested in good faith, and we encourage people to try them. And we do our best to test them to make sure that they're getting it, you know, along the way. But that's just the tools. And then the meat of it is always going to be what each individual discovers.
Man, you're making these practices far more appealing than they ever have been to me in the past. I've always found that there's a rigidity to people who I'm talking to about these systems that you don't seem to have. I think that's fantastic. I had a guest previously on the show who, and it was a wonderful conversation. But you know, he, through his own experimentation and working through the Abramelin ritual in order to achieve the knowledge and conversation with the Holy Guardian Angel, he came to the conclusion that these are objective facts. And I just don't know what to make of that. Yeah. It was hard for me.
Yeah, I guess I'd have to, hear more about which facts are facts, you know. There may be facts of, like I said, landmarks of progress, things that tend to happen repeatably and reliably enough that we could say, here's the stage everyone tends to go through, or most people tend to go through. But that still would only apply to this particular path. You know, there, you could pick some other organization training in an entirely different way that has virtually no overlap in the tool sets, but still helping people attain, you know. So I think to get too dogmatic about any particular path or system is an error.
I agree. Now, back to what I was saying before, mm-hmm. when we're talking about the Holy Guardian Angel and its relationship to the higher self, and the sort of argument that if you spend any amount of time online talking about esotericism, you'll run into is this a part of the self, or is this something external of you? Now, my answer to that has always been, and this is one of the foundational teachings of my own mystery school, is that there is no difference there. There is very little difference there. That is to say that through the understanding of as above, so below, as within, so without, there is no external world of you. The external world is a creation of your mind, which is also what neuroscience tells us, that while there is an external world, it's not this cartoon that you and I are currently experiencing. That is a creation of the mind. It's an interpretation of the external world, and it can only create that interpretation through what is already within you. However, through my own experience with magic and through working with magic and working with the deities, I have manifested things into my life that I thought were otherwise impossible. So there, you're accessing, if it is, let's say it is a part of you, it is a much more powerful part of you than you normally have access to without going through these steps, without attempting this magic.
Yeah, yeah. My friend Lon Duquette likes to say that, yes, it's all in your head, but you just don't know how big your head is. And yes. I think we're getting at similar ideas here, that the, you know, there's an all-encompassing mind with the capital M that we partake of, but also are embedded in, you know, in the universe, and that helps us do the magic to begin with. Yeah, I thought I had another comment on that, but I don't.
No, I know. And you know, this is what I was saying. These are heavy topics, and it's easy to get a little bit lost in them. So I will try to keep us on track, but I've been very excited for this conversation because, again, I just have so many questions. So jump in in the next one. And I have a little anecdote here as well. Now we've talked a little bit about what the Holy Guardian Angel is. Now, from your perspective, mm-hmm. what are angels and what we know as demons? Mm-hmm.
In a way, I guess it's the same answer, because clearly there are repeatable patterns, trends in people's experiences with certain entities that might lead credence to the idea that there are characteristics of a certain entity that show up from person to person. So it's not entirely a subjective thing. You could also argue that some of that is front loading based on something they might have encountered as a description of what they were supposed to experience, but you always have to be cautious of that anyway. So there may be tendencies that a certain angel or archangel or spirit or whatever will embody certain characteristics as it appears to the practitioner, but certainly it's through their own lens, their own psyche, their own predispositions in terms of perception and the way they kind of approach and understand interacting with anything in their lives. So there's some projection of their own personality and their own character there. I just think that the primary distinction with the HGA, to say another word on that in connection with this, is, and this is one reason why it seems so inner and so outer at the same time, or can, that it's so personal. The experience of the HGA is so personal, so specific to who we are and who we've always been and our basic nature or true will, that it seems impossible that it could be out there, because it explains so much about who we are. But at the same mm-hmm. time, the experience is so phenomenally beyond anything we've ever felt as an individual of ourselves, any experience of, oh, this, that's that part of me that thinks this way, or that's that creative part of me, or whatever. It's so beyond that and so seemingly external that it's impossible to feel comfortable saying, oh, this is just, you know, an interior aspect. But that's the essential value of the HGA experience in many ways, that it opens us up to understanding who we are in a deeper way than we ever could have without it. And everything we, you know, all our preferences and our talents and our predispositions are used to enact our true will, are employed by the angel to get us to do our job here on earth, you know. But it's also experientially so much beyond any tool or any predisposition or any aspect of personality or talent or whatever, that, you know, the only answer to this dilemma is to go through it and see, you know, how it manifests for each individual.
Absolutely. Yes, I agree. Now, I want to state here that, and I'm sure I'm ready for the comments, people. Bring them at me. It's fine. Having never before studied much of Crowley beyond a few quotes, let's just leave it as just that. But having gone through many, 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 many years of other magical systems, around 5 years ago, had a confrontation with what I would call my HGA, as I understand it through now understanding, as much as I do understand about Crowley's work. And it was life-changing. It's absolutely life-changing. And it's the reason I'm doing everything that I'm doing now. It's the reason I have a school. It's the reason I have a podcast. It's the reason I do anything in my life, essentially. It was that profound. And yet I didn't go through a single one of the rituals that I was supposed to in order to achieve that. It happened quite by accident and was in fact terrifying. So if I remember correctly, it began to happen one time and I jumped out of my chair and I said no. And then I spent another year reworking it until the point where it was a yes and got there and I was ready for it. But as you were saying, like it was so profound that I can't explain it to anybody. You can't explain this to people. You have to experience it. Now, my question is, because this was my experience, what I was told in this conversation aligns precisely with what, so in astrology, and I practice Western tropical astrology using whole sign houses. And I know everyone's got their opinions about astrology and we're not going to do that, people. Okay. That'd be 10 more episodes, but from my point of view, you can actually at least glimpse a person's true will through their north node placement and through, I use Chaldean numerology. I know there's Chaldean, there's Pythagorean, there's Gematria. I think that they're all quite similar little tweaks and nuance. I tend to use Chaldean, but I believe that through astrology, you can glimpse a person's true will in their north node placement, sort of triangulated with their destiny number and their life path number as being the way in which they will get there. And this is a concept I call the arrow of destiny. And because mine lines up precisely with what I was told in this conversation, my question is that typical?
Are communications with the HGA typically relevant to the true will of a person? Is that the question?
Well, are they relevant to, do they coincide with, or have you seen them override like another system used to sort of derive the same information like astrology or numerology?
Okay. In my experience and in the experience of those I've talked to about their experience, of the HGA, I don't think I've ever heard anyone say, all those ways I was thinking about myself and conceiving of myself were wrong. Like I did my natal chart and now it just seems like that's totally off and what the HGA told me is totally different. You know, what I have experienced and heard over and over is that it adds layers of richness and depth and understanding to everything we've ever thought about ourselves.
So yes.
Including things that didn't make sense before. So it opens up awareness and understanding, it doesn't tend, in my experience, to complicate in a negative way the ways we've been conceiving of ourselves. It just gets bigger. It gets bigger and more profound in terms of the way we can see our path and how something like our time and place of birth might be just one factor that gave us a trajectory that helps us enact our true will. And that, but there's plenty of other things that made that possible too. Our parenting, or the culture we grew up in, the particular teachers we had that unlocked certain capabilities for us, and all of those things may have been conscious awarenesses in us as we approach knowledge and conversation, but then it's a whole other level where we kind of pull back the camera and say, oh, that's what all that was about, and how I had to go through that really shitty period of my life to be shaped to be stronger in this way, and that's what I had to use for the next stage of growth. And it all starts to make much more sense.
Totally. Yes. Man, yeah. I definitely agree. I think that so when this happened for me, it filled in all the little blanks and things I was wondering about, because prior to that experience, I could look at my chart and say, okay, I think I get it. But after that experience, it's like, I totally get it. I totally get it. I see it all plain as day. It all makes sense because it ties everything together. I think that when you're looking at astrology or numerology, those being the two heavy hitters in this area, in my opinion, you're looking at a coding language, essentially. Now that is not an endorsement of simulation theory. And to clarify my stance on this, because people ask me a lot and I write about it a lot, I do not necessarily believe that we are living in a simulation. I believe that you can describe reality through those terms in a way that is very easy for people to understand and effective. But that's not to say that I believe it as objective fact. So just to clarify my stance on that. But I think that when you're looking at astrology or numerology, you're looking at something akin to a coding language. But then when you have this experience, and it doesn't, maybe it's not the experience of your holy guardian angel, maybe it's simply your first contact with spirit in general, which is another thing I'm about to ask you about. you're getting something more akin to human understanding and not machine understanding. You're getting something in words. You're getting something with emotion behind it. You're getting something with feeling that is deeply personal and aimed right at you and isn't simply a map.
Yeah, exactly. And another thing you said about your own path mirrors mine, and also what I've seen a lot of people go through with this, is there's definitely a before and after when it comes to the HJ experience. And I think it's a pretty common life path, observable life path, to see someone's real flowering of their life work happen after the experience. Yes. Like you said, all these things that you've done since you had that experience really have defined what you've become as a person. It sounds like you've really been a flowering of that. And anything anyone knows,
I would have defined myself by my job prior to that. I would have said, I work as a chef. That is who I am. Prior to that experience, I would have leaned heavily. I'm not even a chef anymore. Leaned heavily on that career path that I had chosen as and would have been somewhat lost in defining myself otherwise. And now I can say exactly who I am and what I'm here to do.
Yeah.
And it's not to cook food.
and anything that people know me for, any writing, any public, talks or the podcast or anything else, Living Kalima podcast, it all happened after Knowledge and Conversation. So that's, clearly it opens a door to living out the self in the world in a way that simply wasn't there before.
Okay. We're going to jump back just a little bit here, because we skipped over something I wanted to talk about. It ties into everything else we're talking about.
Of course.
So one thing I would say about this conversation with the HGA, if you have it and you can recognize it, that's important. Is profoundly different than any other form of spirit contact you may have.
Yes.
It is much louder. It is much it hits you much harder. Now, I want to talk about the Goetia, and I want to talk about AWOS. Was okay. AWOS Aleister Crowley's HGA, or was it Rose's HGA, or was it just another spirit entity? Or, the much more popular theory, was it a gray alien?
Well, obviously it's the latter. No, I think first of all, I'm not going to wade into the territory of what it was, because of course I couldn't possibly say what I was, right. is or was. But interpreting Crowley's, the arc of Crowley's understanding of all of these things, it appears that he believed AWOS was an external entity that was in fact his HGA, but also happened to be the herald of the new Aeon, so dictating the book of the law and so on. The arguments about Crowley versus Rose and all of that, that's even harder because it's two people's subjective interpretation of what's going on.
Yeah.
So I may disappoint you with not answering this very, very.
I think you would disappoint me more by having an objective answer, to be honest. It's a yeah. bit of a trick question. But how else do you, you gotta ask it, right?
I speaking of AWOS, though, I think people do glitch a little bit. Like, for example, in Crowley's instruction of the lesser banishing ritual, the pentagram, he recommends that you vibrate the name AWOS at the heart as you're coming down the Kabbalistic cross. And since AWOS has been talked about as Crowley's HGA, some people get to that stage of training and are thinking, why am I using the name of someone else's HGA at my heart? And that's, first of all, that's it's an initial stage of training, and the intention is to... As I think was Crowley's, I think I can speak to that. The intention is to link into the Thelemic current itself through the entity that purportedly dictated the Book of the Law. So in placing AWOS at the heart, it's a way of helping the aspirant link to the Thelemic current until such time as they receive the name of their own HGA, in which case that replaces AWOS. So this is our teaching today in AA and Temple of Silver Star, and it's since it was kind of pretty fundamentally related to the question of who or what is AWOS, I thought I'd speak to that for a minute.
So now I would personally view it, this isn't an argument, just so my way of thinking is that by vibrating at that frequency, yes, of course you're trying to link to the Thelemic current, but I would also say that you're linking to the plane at which AWOS exists, which would probably be the same plane at which your own HGA exists, if they all exist in, I would lean towards the astral being that particular plane. That would be my, and I don't know that. I'm saying that I think that.
I don't disagree with anything you said. I think there's a key to get into a certain state of receptive consciousness to other levels of mind. Kabbalistically, we might say that the HGA lives in the absolutic world, and the Briatic world is the place of meeting, where the world of Bria impinges on the adept center of consciousness at Tiferet, and that's where that marriage happens with the knowledge and conversation, where the consciousness, the lower human consciousness of the adept, is united with the Briatic consciousness of the HGA. But that's just another more technical way of saying what I think you're getting at, which is something like vibrating AWOS at the heart gets us in the right place, gets our head in the right place to mm-hmm. to connect with higher force.
Yeah, and I think it's akin to the way that Buddhist monks will om in an attempt to vibrate their pineal gland, again, to put you in that particular state of consciousness, because that's a very real thing. And this is where I'm coming into this sort of middle ground between a person like yourself and a person, well, not, this is our first conversation. I don't mean to characterize you. You know what I mean? A person who I see, like you. Well, and like Peter, Peter J. Carroll, who wrote Liber Null, which is, to me, was a book that, one of the magical books that really changed my life. I find myself in the middle of you guys. I believe that there are some objective things happening within the spiritual realm that can be sort of said, okay, look, this is common among so many practices. There's something really going on here. Astrology being one of them, the Hermetic principles being one of them, the idea of these different states of consciousness. And even in fact, Peter agrees about that one. Or is it all imagination and the power of imagination, right? It's, I'm somewhere in the middle of that peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Yeah. I think that's the reasonable place to end up with it. And this is a theme we've touched on several times in this conversation. Mm-hmm. You want an openness of a system or training or tools that you're using, so that you can sort of discover your own truths in that. And it won't matter if someone in some book says, here's what this means or not, because you'll know what it all means to you, and that's the key.
I think that word meaning is so important here, because I believe, like you're saying, that what it means to you will be completely personal. So a lot of people, when I have people come to me for tarot readings, a lot of their first question is, I am surrounded by, let's say, this particular type of, I see butterflies everywhere I go. What does it mean? And I say, I can't tell you that. I can't tell you what that means, because what it means is deeply personal to you. You have to discover what it means. I can help you discover what it means to you, but I cannot tell you what that means, because there isn't one objective meaning for butterflies. It is based on so many different things. But as I progress as a magician, I move further away from it's all the power of imagination model, more into there's something really solid happening here. And I find myself kind of going that way a little bit more and more, which brings me kind of back to and forward to my next question, which is, and I'll tell you, I'm reluctant to even touch this thing at this point, but this book, okay. Yes. And specifically this edition of it, which has the foreword by Crowley, because they don't all have this, contains a bit that I've read out loud on this podcast before, but I will do it again despite the consequences.
It's gonna be a long night with those comments.
Yes. You'd think I would have the page marked, and yet I don't. I can probably recite it at this point, but okay, I'll just go ahead and say it. Crowley writes in this foreword to the Goetia that the spirits of the Goetia are portions of the human brain, and that the names of God are vibrations used to control first the mind in general, then specific parts of the brain. Okay, I think I did a pretty good job of paraphrasing that. That seems deeply real to me. Well, at the same time, and I'll say the reason I'm reluctant to even touch this book at this point, if you go back and watch the very first episode of this show, I spoke to Travis McHenry, who created the Occult Tarot Deck, which is a Goetic tarot deck. And the first time I spoke to him on the phone, I hung up the phone and my fire alarm went off. The second time I spoke to him on the phone to tell him that my fire alarm went off the first time, I hung up the phone and my fire alarm went off again. And I got it on video. It's in the first episode. A couple weeks ago, about a month ago now, I was having a Zoom conversation like this with my girlfriend, because she lives five hours away. And I was like saying, oh, hey, I have this book that's haunted and you probably shouldn't touch it. And then she's like, you just touched it. I'm like, yeah, I know. And then a few, maybe 10 minutes goes by. We're talking about other stuff. And she goes a little white. And I'm like, what's going on? She's like, who's that behind you? And that kind of thing is so common anytime I open or touch or talk about this book. And so I tend to tell my students, like, don't go there yet. Let's get through all this other stuff first, because now I've never had any kind of malicious experience, never anything bad, negative, just stuff that's spooky. Can you speak to this, and what do you think is going on here?
Well, I don't have any particular negative or, you know, cautionary advice about the Goetia, except it's very important to remember that the whole point of, to me, it seems, and I think Crowley would agree with this, the whole point of any magical tool, any evocation, any work of any sort in magic is to strengthen the tools that build, that enable us to move toward knowledge and conversation of the HGA, because that unlocks the true will. And that's the point, you know, to be living in a world doing what we're here to do in the world. Mm-hmm. So I think the real danger is getting sidetracked or distracted by rabbit chases into, I need to invoke these particular spirits to get this particular thing to happen, and getting drawn into that as a kind of a mundane, a too mundane game about the physical world that we live in, as opposed to building tools of communication with the universal mind in its various forms. So the spirits of the Goetia, understood as, whether you understand them as parts of the mind, as Crowley originally put in that introduction, or the parts of the mind that open us up to specific aspects of consciousness that are bigger than the mind. You know, there we are back to that either or both question. In any case, I think we've got to remember that the point of the tools is to train ourselves for knowledge and conversation. And in terms of the dangers of, what I see more than anything else in terms of people getting off track is inexperienced magicians messing with tools too early in their work as magicians, feeling like they've gone off track, invoked something or evoked something they can't banish, or they've been changed in a way they don't like, or something's attacking them, or, you know, those sorts of fears, and then they overcompensate in some other way, and the next thing you know, they're bouncing around their magical work like a ping pong ball without a center. And so I think as long as someone has found a way to move toward their center and has got some basic communication there, and this is kind of a higher self thing, like my everyday consciousness in touch with the deepest part of me, you know, Jung would call it the ego self axis, you know, that if we've started to forge that in a way that we can come back to, a well we can drink from reliably, then we'll be centered and protected in the most important ways. And then when we experiment with tools, they won't tend to obsess us or knock us off or make us feel like we've made a misstep. And if we do make a misstep, we don't overreact to it. You know, we bring ourselves back to the center. I hope that makes sense.
It makes so much sense. I fully agree. I think that, so now I don't personally have, I don't know if I can say ever, because I can't exactly recall. I have done one or two rituals in my 20 years of doing this that were aimed at either the jinn or the goetic spirits, which I believe essentially to be the same system with different names. That's another thing people could argue about if they want to. If you do it, argue in the comments. But very, very rarely have I done that. And very rarely also have I done any magic aimed at the Abrahamic angels. And this is largely because I prefer, like, aesthetically prefer paganism. It's just... And pagan archetypes of gods and pantheons. It's just always been my aesthetic preference. I had a a very negative experience at a church when I was younger after my father died, and it turned me off to the entire everything to do with it, essentially. Sure. But as a student of magic, I'm more willing to go look in that direction now.
Yeah.
Anyways, so what I've come to, okay, you are a practicing psychologist. You are a scholar of these things. So I'd like to present to you, if you're willing, my idea about this, and you can tell me if I'm totally off base or if I'm not going on the right track. Would that be okay?
Okay. Sure.
Okay. So what I see is a correlation between what Crowley said, astrology, and Sigmund Freud. I see the conscious, the superconscious, or the ego, the superconscious and the id. And I see the sun, moon, and rising sign in astrology. And I have a different take on this than most astrologers do. I would say that your sun sign is more representative of the higher self, which, or the HGA, which I would put in the category of, not to say the same thing as, but the category of the superconscious. I would say that your ascendant sign, your rising sign, is far more akin to your ego, your earthly self. And then the moon sign, I think we all can recognize as the subconscious. That one's pretty well established. So when I look at this particular pantheon, I'm seeing the Holy Guardian Angel as the superconscious. I'm seeing the 72 angels of the Shemhem Farash being a part of that conscious ego, and the spirits of the Goetia being the archetypes essentially of the id, of the subconscious, of the that part of ourselves that is much harder to control.
Okay. I think there's that resonates with a lot of things that seem true to me. I think the only thing I'd be cautious about is describing all of that in a limiting way, so that the human unconscious mind, I think, has a lot of elements that don't necessarily link to this or that good experience or something. But I think if you want to locate certain classes of beings in the aspect of human consciousness where they kind of this their home territory, I think you're hitting at something pretty useful there, that to see the, let's call them the lower spirits, the individual spirits or demons or whatever word you're using, certainly fit more with those aspects of human unconsciousness that are more primal and less developed, less conscious, less evolved. And as you go into other classes of beings, whether that be the 72 angels, or you start looking at in the Hebrew hierarchies of angels and archangels and so on, on up to the divine names, you start to move up into more exalted aspects of human consciousness itself, placing the HGA more like a superconscious role. Makes a lot of sense, of course. So yeah, I basically liking what I'm hearing. I just think that there's room in that for a lot of other things too.
I agree. And one of the things that I struggle with in this sort of, like, I don't know if I'll call it a theory, this is just the way that I kind of see things and the way that I like to explain them. However, if you read through the Goetia and read through the descriptions of the spirits or demons, whatever you prefer to call them, many of them are performing functions which we would ascribe to the conscious mind, like teaching, logic, rhetoric, and mathematics, right? Those I would ascribe as functions of the conscious mind. So if I am right, then I'm also wrong. And that, that's interesting. And so the only thing it really makes me think is that if I'm going to continue to use this model as something that I'm pushing, as I believe there to be something here, I would say that the subconscious mind, the id, has those functions. It just does not express them the same way that the left brain hemisphere conscious thinking mind, not that it doesn't have those capabilities, that they're expressed very differently. Another way that I tend to like to explain this to my clients, especially when I'm trying to explain some of the things that they may be going through energetically, magically, spiritually, is that you cannot think your way out of this. And here's why. Your conscious thinking mind, if you are a genius, and I mean a true genius, is about as smart as a pocket calculator, right? I mean, I don't know anybody who can add nine numbers together at the same time. Not a single person who can do that with their conscious thinking mind. However, the right brain hemisphere, the subconscious mind, is doing much, 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 much more complicated math than that all the time. It has to, otherwise you would fall apart.
Sure. And you know, that's the part of the human mind that's most deeply intertwined with autonomic functions of the body, all the things that keep us alive. And it's doing it in a way that shows that kind of body wisdom that our conscious mind could not possibly manage. You know,
you can't instruct your hair to stop growing. You can't do that. You know, if we could do those things, I mean, that'd be incredible. And there's an argument made to be about Wim Hof and his work and accessing those functions of the mind, which is incredibly cool. But I certainly can't do it. And I don't want to take ice baths. So I don't think I'll ever gonna be able to do it.
Certainly don't.
My boss in my day job is all about it, and he's good at it. And he'll just like jump right in, and he's like, come on, guys, do it. Not for me. Not yet. Maybe one day. Okay. Anyways, so thank you for answering that. It's something I've been wanting to ask a person like yourself for a very long time. So I really appreciate you offering me your perspective there. So we're kind of running out of time, unfortunately, but I still have so many more questions for you. Let's find a way to wrap this up that would leave the listeners with something to hold on to. So if you could describe, just as an overall arching sort of thesis here, what do you think the benefits of the Crowley system are in contrast to other systems of magic? Why was this the choice for you, and why would you recommend it to others? And by the way, just to throw this plug in there also, like, yeah, get this book. It's fantastic. It's the only book on Crowley, Thelema, or this whole topic that's ever really held my attention and made me want to read the whole book, right? Like, if I were to pick up this one, I've never once in my life finished this book, and I've had it clearly for a very long time. It's very difficult. This one, again, great book, some great ideas in there, but oh my gosh, your book is very readable.
I'm very glad to hear that. It's certainly, that was my aim. Because I think that all this is very approachable. It's just easy to feel like it isn't when you're reading certain Crowley source materials, and some more than others. I think, of course, knowing Crowley, the central issue there is the assumptions he was making about the familiarity of any given reader with all of the stuff that he was familiar with. He was not, I think, especially good as an instructor of beginners. And I, you know, 30 years later, I still look back and getting new things out of some of those source texts that I read many times over the years, but still realizing that, that's what he was getting at. So, you know, it's one of those unfolding things that you'll always discover more. But in any case, I think the value of the system for me personally, start with that, was that I was at that time in my life, as early mid-20s, looking for a way to approach a path of mystery, inner life mystery, spiritual connectedness, but I wasn't ready to say that I certainly wasn't going to go back to the religion of my upbringing or anything like that. I was kind of raised middle of the road Methodist, you know, but I needed to find a system that had enough room in it for all of the mysteries of the human consciousness and all of the unexplainable aspects of self in the world. And really, Carl Jung was the gateway for me. Through Jung, I found Rigardi, and through Rigardi, I found Crowley. So that whole world of the overlap of psychology and magic was my doorway in. But once I started really diving into Crowley's system and working it, I realized kind of what I've been saying in response to some of your questions today, that there are milestones that are really useful, but there's also so much room for us to discover ourselves in it, to really unlock those doors where the keys are the only ones we could find. And what Crowley's done is what I think is a brilliant job in the structure of the system of AA, of providing a set of tools without too much attached doctrine and dogma, letting people experiment with them. And if it's competently run as an organization, something like the AA or Temple of the Silver Star can help people not fall into pitfalls, not reinvent the wheel if they don't have to, know that someone who's been through what they're doing and experimented with the same tools is helping them experiment with the tools. And I don't know what my life would be if I hadn't done this. I can't imagine that I would have found myself to be the human I am if I hadn't walked this path. Sure, you could argue that some other path might have unlocked similar things, but certainly doesn't feel like it. And so what I see in individuals who commit to this work, and work with it diligently through all the crappy times and the dark nights and so on, the reward is that you become yourself in a richer way than you've ever dreamed possible. And what you bring to your life, the people in your life, the world around you, is so much richer and deeper because of that. So, you know, fundamentally, that's the point to me, that the system seems to be reliably structured so that a well-meaning individual who's diligent can completely overhaul themselves and make the world a better place. It's ultimately to me about that service.
Again, David, what a fantastic response. I feel exactly the same way about teaching magic in general, about any path that leads you to that sort of contact with your true will, or with the spiritual aspects of reality, with the spiritual aspects of yourself. And in fact, that is my entire mission through my school, through this show, through everything I do, is to help people to the extent that I can to alleviate some of the mental health crisis that I feel that we are going through as a species, and a tremendous amount of that crisis being caused by the disconnection between the spiritual aspects of reality and the physical aspects of reality. So any way in which you can help a person get there is an extremely noble cause. I'm all for it, and I think your work is fantastic. Now, that being said, okay, this is one last question, final question. Sure. And this is another one that people will argue about all the time. Do you feel that Crowley was successful within his own system?
In terms of personal attainment?
Yes.
Yeah. Let's not take this too seriously, but I do sometimes like to posit that, what if the real point of Crowley's system is, as demonstrated by his life, that you construct your own reality so efficiently that you find yourself to be at the center of the cosmos and heralding a new and a human consciousness that portrays you as the prophet figure of an entire movement. Now that sounds crazy, but if the point of the system is to unlock the real center of each person's being, then wouldn't a good demonstration of that be for someone to have founded a system that holds them in there as their attained self at its center. So that's just one way of looking at it. But I think what Crowley did demonstrates of knowledge and conversation, demonstrates the world-changing possibilities when someone crosses the abyss and attains to that kind of transpersonal, transhuman level of consciousness, and builds, cultivates a system for promulgating that, propagating that. Obviously, in his lifetime, he was reviled, and you know that whole wickedest man in the world stuff from the 20s and so on. That never really, he never really escaped that in his lifetime, and still, you know, obviously. But if we look at what he was able to systematize and leave behind, and the depth of his thought about all these things, I that seems like the fruits of an adept and a master to me. That has nothing to do with his personality, his human character, his life choices, or stuff like that. It's kind of like evaluating the art rather than focusing too much on the biography of the artist.
Yeah,
I agree. I do feel that, you know, and this is a difficult one because we weren't there, right? He died in the 1940s. But through what I understand of his history, you know, towards the end of his life, he'd fallen apart a bit, or was, you know, he's using more substances and kind of, I mean, like I said, I don't know, because all this, I don't have any reliable sources on this, right? Yeah. We have the internet and we have what we read. But I would say that there's purpose, if that's true. Let's say that towards the end of Crowley's life, you know, he wasn't doing so great. He went off the deep end a little bit. Like, if we start from that assumption point, even there could be something really beautiful in that you can create a system that helps thousands of people throughout time, and that it doesn't make you infallible in any way, shape, or form, right? And I do believe, sure, my personal belief, and I typically do not like to moralize at people, it's something I avoid, but my personal belief is that if you want to be successful within any magical system, there has to be a weight and balance where you temper that, yes, I am the center of my own universe, with humility and with right, appreciation for all things greater than you, and also with a real, like, and again, this is part of alleviating mental health crises, and part of which I think are caused by cognitive dissonance. Like, we have to strive to be good people. We really do, or magic can mess you up. And that's something I've witnessed.
Yeah. I mean, and that speaks to the encouragement of people to be psychologically balanced as they approach their magical work, and to have that as a part of their magical work. We certainly do in Temple of the Silver Star. My teacher, Phyllis Seckler, was very focused on, Sora Merrill was very focused on psychological balance, Brigardi, so on. But in Thelemic terminology and cosmology, what we're talking about is the distinction between the Hadith point of view and a Nuit point of view. Mm-hmm. Hadith is that point of view that is uniquely individual, and everything is seen through that lens. So that's the sort of individual, I'm going to attain, and you know, I'm the center of the universe kind of consciousness. The Nuit consciousness is that holistic, I'm one with everything kind of awareness, and it's the interplay between those two that brings the real fruits of the work, that allows us to see how we're godlike creative beings in our individuality, but also we're just a star in the heavens like all the others, and of no better or worse than any other star. There is humility in that, as you said, to use your word. There's also the power of the Hadith perspective. I guess I wanted to comment quickly on Crowley's life, end of life stuff that you were noting. Yeah, of course, for those who don't know, he had asthma and had heroin prescribed originally for asthma. He did a lot of experimentation voluntarily with all kinds of substances, but his health was worsening physically toward the end of his life, yeah, for sure. And the addiction was part of that. But if you look at his output, his letters, the books that he authored toward the end of his life, say the last decade or so, to me, those aren't fall apart-y kind of books. Those and correspondences, those show someone who's actually more deeply rooted in the spiritual truths he was seeking all along, and more able to leave his ego outside the door and try to communicate something of value to his students. I see more compassion and more humility, more the kind of wisdom of older age where you realize what a shithead you were when you were 25, that sort of stuff. Yeah. Yeah. You see more of that in his later work. So I actually think he was falling together psychologically, even though physically he was not doing well.
That's very interesting. Can you actually make a recommendation for something to read from that time period?
The best biography of Crowley that I've ever encountered is my friend Richard Kaczynski's book called Perdurabo. Pretty definitive. I was with Richard last night, actually. He lives here in North Carolina. That's a wonderful biography for anybody who really wants to get that knowledge from somebody who's working Crowley's systems. So it's not a complete outsider, but Richard is also not going to gloss over the ugly bits. And mm-hmm. So I can hardly recommend that biography, Perdurabo.
Okay, fantastic. I will link that in the description as well as links to your works and your podcast, your YouTube channel, all of that. And I think that's a great place to end this. Look at that. We're going to end right at 11:11. Fantastic. Okay, David, thank you so much. This has been an enlightening and wonderful conversation. I really can't thank you enough for being on the show.
Well, very happy to be here. And I was really enjoying the different kinds of questions that you were posing today, as was your mission at the beginning, I think. So it's very refreshing to go in different places. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Bye, everybody. Cut. Oh, man. Thank you so much. That was awesome.
Well, glad that fits the bill. Yeah, I enjoyed that. Like I said, it is, you've probably heard at least one or two of my other interviews, but it does tend to go to, how did you first get interested in Thelema? What is Thelema about, for those who don't know? You know, so it was great to go into some more technical zones. And
cool. I know I didn't give you any warning. So, I mean, I feel like this went, I is better than I was hoping for, honestly. So good. After reading your book, I had no doubt that I would just be able to ask you the questions and you would have an answer. I didn't think you were going to have to say, I want to go get my notes or anything like that. You clearly know what you're talking about. And, I think that the best podcasts, the most captivating ones are not scripted in any way. Oh, sure, And the downside to that is that I forget stuff. Like, I forget to plug my own mystery school in the intro. That's fine. I think that people need to get used to that, because if they do attend my program, they're going to realize it's just me ranting for an hour once a week and they pay for it.
Right.
But, they seem to enjoy it.
Ranting with wisdom. That's the good thing about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's almost like a channeling state, when you're talking passionately about something. Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the most HGA things, that happens in everyday life is during teaching or therapy sometimes, when conducting therapy, you feel like something's talking through you, and it's, at least that's my experience of it. Mm-hmm. It's not just I'm formulating thoughts and this is, this linear path of what I'm going to say. It's, something starts to shine a little bit that is really bigger than us, and but also us.
Yeah,
I love
Yeah, exactly. Something comes through you that, and I've said this a number of times on the show as well, like that I can tell the difference between spiritual wisdom that's given to me and my own thoughts, because when it's given to me in that way, it comes through in a way that's poetic. I'm not poetic. It comes through in a way that is, that has metaphors that I then need to spend time unwrapping. It comes through in layers, in, you know, so many layers that it's not apparent to me right away. Oh man, something I forgot to even mention during the recording. When you were talking about being given, you know, Crowley being given the name AWOS. So, gosh, I would love to do a part two because there's so much more to talk about here. But part of my experience, again, having not gone through anything Crowley related at all, this is a number of years ago, was I was given a mantra which contains the name of my HGA, which, if you don't mind me sharing with you, came through as Enki, which is one of the Sumerian gods. And I still don't know what it means because it's in Sumerian. And I don't know anybody who speaks Sumerian. I believe it's in Sumerian. It's very clear. I've written it down a million times, but I know the sound of it. And if I go into a meditative state, repeating it in my mind, I can get there. But I don't know what the words mean.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. That's great. Crazy. That reminds me of some of my experiences with, I did a book called The Winds of Wisdom, which is my results of scrying the 30 Enochian Aethers, like Crowley did with Vision and the Voice. And one of the things that happened with that is that I was, you know, when in the vision, things were said to me in Enochian, and I'm not fluent in conversational Enochian. I studied the language, but without translating it, which I eventually did, I wasn't going to know what it meant. But when you get things like that, where there's no way your conscious mind could have formulated something that makes sense in some language you don't know, and then later you go back and it's poetry in another language, you know, that's one form of verification that this is there is something objective about this. One metaphor, by the way, I wanted to lay on you, and I'd love to do part two to say more like stuff like this, but like the essence of the thing is like a coat rack. You know, like there's something about a particular spirit's nature, or an archetype in Jungian terms, that's like potential. And there's this coat rack with a peg on it, and that peg is there for everyone, but everyone comes with their own thing to hang on it, you know?
Yeah.
So there's that objective part that's always there and is universal, and everyone finds it. But where that ends up looking based on our own material that we hang on, it could be so individualized that sometimes we miss that there's something objective. Anyway, that's just a
I totally agree.
Way that works.
I know I've got to go to work, but I just one last thing. I've got to work this week on a Saturday because I got to. Anyways, but okay, I digress. That was perfect, and I'm going to remember what you just said, because while Peter Carroll would say nothing is true, everything is permitted, which is an axiom of chaos magic. Mm. I would say that the coat rack is true. Like the coat hanger is true, but the coat is completely up to your imagination. And Hagen von Tullian, who's also a friend of Peter's, who I've had on the show a couple of times, he's described it as like you have a gift. The gift is the gift, but how you wrap it, totally up to you.
I like it.
Yeah, I like it too. Okay. I've got to go. We could talk forever. So, but I've got to go to work. Thank you so much, David. I'll shoot you an email. We'll talk about links and send me a photo for the thumbnail and all that. Usually I have these up about a week from today. I'm hope to have it posted to YouTube and Spotify.
Okay. Yeah. Just let me know what you need and I'll get it to you.
Awesome. Okay. Thanks again, David. Talk to you later.
Bye. Yeah. Thanks. Bye-bye.